Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In, by Bernie Sanders, read by Bernie Sanders and Mark Ruffalo.
This book is dedicated to my parents, Eli and Dorothy Sanders, and to my entire family, my wife Jane, my brother Larry, my children Levy, Heather, Karina, and Dave, and their spouses, Rainey, Mark, Blake, and Liza, and my grandchildren, Sonny, Cole, Riley, Grayson, Ella, Tess, and Dylan. Their love and support have always sustained me. This book is also dedicated to the hundreds of thousands of volunteers who work so hard in so many ways to make our campaign a success. You have made me optimistic about the future of our country. Don't give up. The struggle must continue. Introduction. When we began our race for the presidency in April 2015, we were considered by the political establishment and the media to be a quote-unquote fringe campaign, something not to be taken seriously. After all, I was a senator from a small state with very little name recognition. Our campaign had no money, no political organization, and we were taking on the entire Democratic Party establishment. And by the way, we were also running against the most powerful political operation in the country. The Clinton machine had won the presidency for Bill Clinton twice and almost won the Democratic presidential nomination for Hillary Clinton in 2008. When our campaign finally came to a close in July 2016, it turned out that the pundits had got it wrong, big time. We had made history and run one of the most consequential campaigns in the modern history of our country, a campaign that would, in a very profound way, change America. We received more than 13 million votes in primaries and caucuses throughout the country. We won 22 states, more than a few by landslide proportions. We won 1,846 pledged delegates to the Democratic Convention, 46% of the total. Importantly, in virtually every state, we won a strong majority of younger people, the future of America. We won large percentages of the vote from white, black, Latino, Asian American, and Native American youth. We set the agenda for the America of tomorrow. On April 25, 2016, The Washington Post reported on a poll conducted by the Harvard Institute of Politics. The data collected by researchers at Harvard University suggests that not only has Sanders' campaign made for an unexpectedly competitive Democratic primary, he has also changed the way millennials think about politics, said polling director John Della Volpe. He's not moving a party to the left, he's moving a generation to the left, Della Volpe said of the senator from Vermont. Whether or not he's winning or losing, it's really that he's impacting the way in which a generation, the largest generation in the history of America, thinks about politics. At a time when political apathy is high, voter turnout is abysmally low, and millions of Americans are giving up on the political process, our campaign attracted the energetic support of hundreds of thousands of volunteers in every state in the country. We had the largest rallies of the campaign, and in total, more than 1.4 million people attended our public meetings. As a result of our victories in a number of states, there are now at least 5 new chairs of state Democratic parties who are elected as part of the political revolution. Further, there are a number of progressive candidates energized and supported by our campaign running for office for everything from school board to the U.S. Congress, and many of them will win. New blood, new energy in the political process. And we showed, in a way that can change politics in America forever, that you can run a competitive national grassroots campaign without begging millionaires and billionaires for campaign contributions. We, proudly, were the only campaign not to have a super PAC. In a manner unprecedented in American history, we received some 8 million individual campaign contributions. The average contribution was $27. These donations came from 2.5 million Americans, the vast majority of whom were low or moderate income people. During the campaign, we forced discussion on issues the establishment had swept under the rug for far too long. We brought attention to the grotesque level of income and wealth inequality in this country and the importance of breaking up the large banks that brought our economy to the brink of collapse. We exposed our horrendous trade policies, our broken criminal justice system, and our people's lack of access to affordable health care and higher education. We addressed the global crisis of climate change, the need for real comprehensive immigration reform, the importance of developing a foreign policy that values diplomacy over war, and so much more. Importantly, the support that we won showed that our ideas were not outside of the mainstream. We showed that millions of Americans want a bold, progressive agenda that takes on the billionaire class and creates a government that works for all of us and not just for big campaign donors. The widespread and popular support we received for our agenda helped transform the Democratic Party and forced Secretary Clinton to move her position closer to ours in a number of areas. She began the campaign as a supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and the Keystone Pipeline. She ended up being in opposition to both. As a result of negotiations between the two camps after the campaign ended, Secretary Clinton adopted bold positions on higher education and health care that moved her closer to what we had advocated. Our campaign also had a huge impact on the writing of the most progressive platform by far in the history of the Democratic Party. Despite being in the minority, our supporters ended up shaping much of that platform. Here is some of what the Democratic Party of 2016 stands for. A $15 an hour federal minimum wage, the expansion of Social Security benefits, and the creation of millions of new jobs that will be needed to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. The breaking up of too big to fail banks and the creation of a 21st century Glass-Steagall Act. The closing of loopholes that allows multinational corporations to avoid federal taxes by stashing their cash in offshore tax havens. The combating of climate change by putting a price on carbon and transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels. Major criminal justice reform, including the abolition of the death penalty, the ending of private prisons, and the establishment of a path toward the legalization of marijuana. The passage of comprehensive immigration reform, the most expansive agenda ever for protecting Native American rights. During the 15 months of the campaign, there was one central point that I made over and over again, and let me repeat it here. This campaign was never just about electing a president of the United States, as enormously important as that was. This campaign was about transforming America. It was about the understanding that real change never takes place from the top on down. It always takes place from the bottom on up. It takes place when ordinary people, by the millions, are prepared to stand up and fight for justice. That's what the history of the trade union movement is about. That's what the history of the women's movement is about. That's what the history of the civil rights movement is about. That's what the history of the gay rights movement is about. That's what the history of the environmental movement is about. That's what any serious movement for justice is about. That is what the political revolution is about. I ended this campaign far more optimistic about the future of our country than when I began. How could it be otherwise? In fields in California, I spoke to thousands of working people from every conceivable background who came together determined to transform our country. They were farm workers, environmentalists, gay activists, and students. They know, and I know, that we are stronger when we stand together and do not allow demagogues to divide us by race, gender, sexual orientation, or where we were born. In Portland, Maine, on a cold day, my staff watched people wait outside on long lines for hours, determined to cast their votes at the caucus there. In Arizona, it took some people 5 hours to cast the vote, but they stayed and voted. All across this country, people are fighting back to create the vibrant democracy that we desperately need and to stop our drift toward oligarchy. In New York City, I walked the picket line with striking workers at Verizon who were determined not to see the company cut benefits and outsource jobs. They stood up against outrageous corporate greed. They stood together as a proud union, and they won. In Washington, D.C., I marched with low-wage workers who told the world that they cannot survive on the starvation minimum wage that currently exists, that we need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Their message and their fight is reverberating all across the country. This book describes the history-making campaign that we ran, but more important, it looks to the future. It lays out a new path for America based on principles of economic, social, racial, and environmental justice. On behalf of our children and our grandchildren, it is a path that must be followed and a fight that must be won. The struggle continues. Part 1, Running for President. Chapter 1, How Do We Turn Out the Way We Do? Brooklyn. I grew up in a 3.5-room rent-controlled apartment. My older brother Larry and I spent years sleeping on couches in the living room. During the 2016 New York State primary, in order to remind New Yorkers that I had grown up in Brooklyn, we held a rally on the street where I was raised, East 26th Street. 56 years after I had left, I had a chance to visit the apartment where I spent my first 18 years. Somehow it had shrunk. God, it was small. The kitchen dining room was tiny. It was hard to imagine our family of four having dinner there every night together. And the whole apartment building looked dingier than I had remembered, and so many apartments on one floor. One of my first memories was being on the sidewalk outside of the apartment house where we lived on Kings Highway in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn. There was a military parade. It was the end of World War II. I was 4 years old. That war, Hitler, and the Holocaust surely played a major role in shaping the direction of my life. I remember the photos of my father's family in Poland killed by the Nazis. I remember a telephone call in the middle of the night, which never happened in our apartment, telling my father the good news that a cousin of his was still alive and in a displaced persons camp. I remember crying whenever I saw photos in a book about the destruction of the Jews. I remember seeing people in the neighborhood with tattooed numbers on their arms, survivors of concentration camps. I remember the excitement in the community at the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. No question about it, being Jewish, the loss of family, including children my own age in the Holocaust, the rise to power of a right-wing lunatic and a free election in Germany, a war that killed 50 million people, including more than one-third of all Jews on the planet, all of this had an indelible impact upon my life and thinking. My brother Larry, 6 years older than me, introduced me to politics and a whole lot else. He has played an enormously important role in my life, and I am forever grateful for his love, counsel, and overall wisdom. For the last 50 years, he has lived in Oxford, England, where he raised his family and worked as a social worker. 10 years ago, he was elected to the Oxfordshire County Council as a candidate of the Green Party, and he was re-elected for a second term. He is now active in efforts to maintain a strong national health service system in the UK. My mother taught Larry how to read when he was very young, and he has been a voracious reader for his entire life. Larry first read to me when I was 4 or 5. We would stay in bed late on Saturday mornings going through stacks of comic books. When we were kids, he was my mentor and, as older brothers occasionally are, my tormentor. He was very smart, always knew the answers that I didn't, and he let me know it. Being an older brother is not easy. Occasionally, when you want to go out and spend time with your friends, you have to take care of your kid brother and drag him along. Not fun. On Saturdays, if my parents were away, Larry would also have to prepare lunch for me. I thought his cooking was great. His spaghetti with ketchup and his mighty fine chocolate pudding were outstanding. My parents were not much into reading books, and there were few of them in the house. While we borrowed books from the local library, it was Larry who first brought books into our home and onto a bookshelf. More important, it was Larry who helped me understand what some of those books were about. He was a good teacher and opened my eyes to so much. While my parents were not particularly political, they always voted Democratic, as did virtually the entire Jewish neighborhood in which we lived. Larry brought politics in the house when, as a student at Brooklyn College, he joined the Young Democrats and campaigned for Adlai Stevenson in 1956. During my presidential campaign, I was delighted that Larry and his wife Janet and son Jacob were able to join me at some of our events. I was even prouder when, as a delegate from Democrats abroad at the Democratic Convention, he cast, with tears in his eyes, his one vote for my nomination. Was my family poor? No. Did we, as the economists say, have much discretionary income? Absolutely not. My dad was a paint salesman with the Keystone Paint and Varnish Company. He came to this country from Poland at the age of 17 without a nickel in his pocket. He was always employed and made enough money to provide for his wife, Dorothy, and his two sons, but not much more than that. Money, or more appropriately, lack of money, was always a point of contention in the house. There were arguments and more arguments between my parents, painful arguments, bitter arguments, arguments that seared through a little boy's brain, never to be forgotten. "Bernard, go out and get some groceries. Here's what we need. Here's the list," my mother said. And, dutiful son of 12, I went out and bought the groceries. But I went to the wrong store. I went to the small shop a few blocks away, rather than the Woolbounds grocery store on Nostrand Avenue. I paid more than I should have. When I returned and my mother realized what I had done, the screaming was horrible. Money was hard to come by, not to be wasted. When I was 13, I wanted a leather jacket. It was the fashion. Everyone had one, and I was tired of my brother's hand-me-down coat. "Okay," said Mom, "let's get you a leather jacket." This became the shopping trip from hell. It's probably why 62 years later, ask my wife if I'm lying, I still hate shopping, and why I want to escape if I am in a department store for more than a half hour. On that day, my mother took me to at least a dozen stores in search of the lowest price on a leather jacket. We started off at several stores of the Kings Highway Shopping District. Then we got on the subway to the large department stores in downtown Brooklyn and Manhattan. There was no leather jacket in New York City that I didn't try on. Well, you guessed it. We ended up buying the jacket from the first store we had visited on Kings Highway much earlier in the day. It's funny to think about that now. It wasn't funny then. How much money your family had determined the quality of your baseball glove, which brand of sneakers you wore, and what kind of car your father drove. It also, of course, determined whether you lived in a rent-controlled apartment house, as most of my friends did, or a quote-unquote private house. Not until I was much older did I learn that most people did not refer to the average house on a street as a quote-unquote private house. But that distinction was very clear where I lived. Those of us who lived in apartment houses were working class, and those who lived in private houses were middle class. It was one of the early class distinctions that I remember. I spent most of my childhood playing out on the street or in schoolyards. The street was our world, and we never left home without a pink, Spalding rubber ball. Unlike today, there was no adult supervision, none at all. We organized all the games by ourselves. We played hour after hour after hour. On the street, we played hide-and-seek, punch ball, hockey, two-hand touch football, and stickball, with timeouts when cars passed by and strict rules as to what happened when the ball got stuck under a parked car. We pitched marbles into sewer grates. If your marble went down the hole in the middle, you got 10 marbles back. We played wall ball against the sides of the buildings. We played box ball on the sidewalk, curb ball against the curbs, and stoop ball against the stoops. We played regular handball and Chinese handball. We flipped baseball cards. We raced. In the schoolyard of PS 197, where I went to elementary school, a few blocks from where I lived, we played softball and basketball until we were so tired that we could barely drag ourselves home. For nourishment, we chipped in to buy a large bottle of soda. What I learned playing on the streets and playgrounds of Brooklyn was not just how to become a decent ball player and athlete. I learned a profound lesson about democracy and self-rule. From playing punch ball and stick ball? Yes. There were no adults on the streets or playgrounds where we spent much of our lives. Nobody supervised us. Nobody coached us. Nobody refereed our games. We were on our own. Everything was organized and determined by the kids themselves. The group worked out our disagreements, made all the decisions, and learned how to live with them. What game should we play? Hey, that's a great idea. Let's do it. Can I borrow your baseball glove? Who brought the bat and ball? Was he safe or was he out? Was the ball foul or was it fair? There was no debate about who played on which side. Everyone knew who was the best, second best, and third best basketball player when we chose up teams. That's the way it was. In three-man basketball, the team that lost went to the sidelines, and a new team replaced them to challenge the winners. Those were the rules, and it all worked out. It was, as I think about it now, an amazingly democratic and self-sustaining community, which taught me lessons about working with people that I've never forgotten. The other thing I've never forgotten was the relationship that the kids on the block and the entire community had with the Brooklyn Dodgers. Sometimes as I travel about, I am asked which baseball team I rooted for when I was growing up. Are you kidding? There was only one team, and they were family. Gil Hodges at first, Jackie Robinson or Junior Gilliam at second, Pee Wee Reese, my favorite player at shortstop, Billy Cox at third, Gina Mansky in left field, the Duke in center, Carl Ferrillo in right, Roy Campanella behind the plate. On the mound, we had Preacher O, Don Newcomb, Carl Erskine, Johnny Padres, Clem Levine, Joe Black, Sandy Koufax, among many others. Those names are indelibly planted on my mind. 60 years have come and gone, and I remember those mythical figures like it was yesterday. It would have been unthinkable for anyone on the block not to know the names of the players, their batting averages, and the win-loss record of the pitchers. We knew who they were playing on a given day, where they were playing, who was pitching, and how many games out of first place they might be. We also knew as much information about their personal lives as the baseball cards we flipped and traded provided. Most of our contact with the Dodgers came through the radio and TV play-by-play commentary of Red Barber and Vin Scully, who were as familiar to us as the players. Ebbets Field, where the Dodgers played, was a half-hour subway ride away, and we would go to the ball games a few Saturdays or Sundays a season, sometimes for a doubleheader. Usually, we got the 60-cent bleacher seats, sometimes the buck-and-a-quarter seats, way up on the first baseline. On occasion, we would wait outside the players' entrance to get autographs. I still remember seeing a tired Jackie Robinson walking out of the ballpark. The Dodgers brought joy and despair to our world. What kid who grew up in Brooklyn does not still remember the end of the 1951 season and the collapse of the Dodgers, who gave up a 13-game lead to the hated New York Giants? And then the playoffs, and Ralph Branca, and Bobby Thompson's home run, the shot heard around the world. But better times came in 1955. Finally, the Dodgers beat the Yankees and won the World Series. Johnny Padres, the hero, mass hysteria in Brooklyn. You do not have to be a sociologist to understand the impact that the Dodgers had on the people of Brooklyn, race relations, and our sense of community. As kids, we all knew, of course, that Jackie Robinson, Don Newcomb, and Roy Campanella were black. But what was far more important to us was that they were great ballplayers. We were not bleeding-heart liberals. We just wanted the Dodgers to win. Of course they were part of our family. There was a saying that went around Brooklyn during the time that the Dodgers were about to leave for Los Angeles. It went like this. The three worst people in modern history were Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Walter O'Malley, but not necessarily in that order. The departure of the Dodgers, orchestrated by O'Malley, the team owner, was devastating to the borough and to the city. It left a gaping hole. Frankly, as a non-political teenager, I found it very difficult to understand how the Dodgers could be moved. This team was the Brooklyn Dodgers, you know, like the Brooklyn Bridge, like Brooklyn College, like the borough of Brooklyn. How could you take something away that was an essential part of the life of the people and that meant so much to them? O'Malley's devastating decision to rip the Dodgers out of Brooklyn in order to pursue greater profits on the West Coast was, I suspect, one of my first observations regarding the deficiencies of capitalism. But my childhood experiences were not just on the streets of Brooklyn. I will never forget one summer when I was 13 years old and my parents sent me to the 10 Mile River Scout Camp in Narrowsburg, New York. It was an inexpensive way for kids to get out of the city during the summer. My first summer at the camp was supposed to be 4 weeks. I came home after two. I was homesick. The next year, I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks. I stayed four. I had a great time. The last time I went, I stayed for 6 weeks and cried when I had to come back to the city. As a kid, I had been in the Cub Scouts, where my mom was a den mother and later was part of Troop 356 in the Boy Scouts. Our troop went on occasional hikes and cookouts, but it was nothing like summer camp. Boy Scout camp was an extraordinary experience for me. For the first time in my life, I was exposed to the outdoors and a rural way of life. Living in a lean-to without a front door, spending nights in a sleeping bag on a straw-filled mattress, hiking, camping, observing beautiful starry nights for the first time in my life, learning about Indian lore, swimming in the lake, canoeing, having communal meals in a giant mess hall, singing folk songs. One day, my bunkmate and I were sitting on our beds reading comic books. A rather large black snake slithered across the upper bunk bed on my friend's side of the cabin. The snake was heading down toward his shoulder. We ran like hell. Quite the experience for a boy from Brooklyn. Going to Boy Scout camp changed my life. It turns out that I really liked country living, and I never forgot that. I doubt very much that I would have ended up in Vermont, one of the most rural states in the country, if I hadn't gone to scout camp. High school for me, James Madison High School, was not as much fun as my days in elementary school. The school was much larger and, unlike PS 197, where I had known almost all the kids for my whole life, there were a lot of new faces. I was a good student in high school, but not a great one. The social studies interested me more than math and science. I ran for senior class president. I remember pacing up and down the bedroom floor as I worked with my mother on the speech I was going to give in the school auditorium. My main campaign platform called for the high school to adopt a South Korean war orphan. I lost that election. The fellow who won, however, eventually took my idea. Our school adopted that child. One of the first great disappointments of my young life was not making the James Madison High School basketball team. Consistently one of the better teams in the city, under the legendary leadership of its longtime coach, Jamie Moskowitz. How happy I was to have made the junior varsity team in my freshman year. I came home with a beautiful uniform, number 10. If truth be told, I even slept in that silky uniform. But then disaster struck. At a practice early in the season, I was told by the coach that I was cut. No junior varsity team, no varsity team in the future, no beautiful uniform, a crushing experience. I don't remember exactly why, but I then went out for the track and cross-country teams. As a kid, I always had good endurance and could run forever. Track and cross-country were not as sexy as basketball, no large crowds at the meets, not as much attention. But it turned out to be an exciting and meaningful experience for me. I enjoyed it very much, and I was pretty good at it. There were long subway rides from Brooklyn to Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx for the cross-country events. There were the many hundreds of runners at the starting line, and then, after the starter's gun went off, the mad dash into the woods for the 2.5-mile run. There was the smell of the fall leaves on the ground through the deep breaths of a body pushing hard. There was the final kick down the long straightaway to the finish line, passing runners who were even more tired than me. Great experiences that I have never forgotten. I was a good runner, not just in cross-country, but in the mile and half-mile events. I ran the mile in 4:37, fast enough for third place in the New York City Indoor Mile Championship. I also won a number of borough and local meets. Running track and cross-country turned out to be important to my life. Training hard, not quitting even when you were dead tired, gave me a discipline that has stayed with me for the rest of my life. Chicago. It was around midnight at LaGuardia Airport. I was 19 years of age and on my very first plane trip, taking the cheapest flight available to Chicago. I said goodbye to my dad, scared and apprehensive. I was leaving home and heading to the University of Chicago. My mother had died a few months before. I wanted out of Brooklyn and Brooklyn College, where I had attended my freshman year. I had a friend who was already at the university, so I applied and was accepted. The school apparently had some slots to fill in their sophomore class, even for a student who was below their quite high academic standards. The plane landed at 3 a.m., and I made my way from Midway Airport to the Hyde Park neighborhood on Chicago's south side. Attending the University of Chicago was an eye-opening experience for me. It changed my life and, for better or worse, helped shape me into the person I am today. But it was also a very difficult time. My dad had dropped out of school at the age of 16 in Poland. Having lived through the Depression He worried a lot about money and making a living. He preferred that I not go to college, but get a steady job after high school. My mother was a housewife who graduated high school in New York City, but never went further in her education. Most of our friends and neighbors were from a similar background. At the University of Chicago, most of my fellow students were children of college graduates. Their parents were successful professionals or business people. I felt very out of place and a bit over my head. At times, it was quite lonely. While I struggled personally, the University of Chicago opened up opportunities for me that I had never experienced before. I enjoyed many of my teachers, but my intellectual interests were taking me outside of the classroom and into subject matters that were not necessarily part of the curriculum. In Harper Library, the university had one of the great libraries in the country. I spent a lot of time there, deep, deep down in the stacks. While I was often unprepared for class and exams and earning rather unspectacular grades, I was reading up on all kinds of subjects. I studied history, sociology, psychology, economics, and politics. I read about aspects of American history and life that I had never been exposed to before. I learned that America was not always, quote, the land of the free and the home of the brave, and that our country was not always on the right side of history. I also read many biographies. I was blown away by the number of magazines and periodicals that were in the large and beautiful reading room on campus. Who knew that so many publications existed? And on every conceivable subject and from all over the world. I would often come to the reading room intending to study for a classroom assignment, but end up spending the evening absorbed in one magazine or another in the periodical room. It was there that I was first exposed to The Nation, to Monthly Review, to The Progressive magazine, and other progressive publications. My political views were developing. I also began to read critically. When I was in high school, if you wanted to win an argument, it was enough to point out that, quote, it said so in the newspaper, end quote. Well, I was learning to my amazement that different publications had different points of view and that what appeared in a newspaper was not necessarily true. But I was not only reading, I was running. During my first year at the university, I went out for the cross-country and track teams and did pretty well. While the University of Chicago was by no means a big-time athletic school, its facilities were far superior to anything that I had ever seen. There were beautiful indoor and outdoor tracks, and I was amazed that you could throw your sweaty track clothes into a hamper and they would be returned to you all cleaned and folded the next day. While on the track team, I ran the half mile in under 2 minutes, my best performance ever. Ironically, while I took interesting classes and spent long hours buried in the library stacks on campus, much of my learning during my years in Chicago took place off campus through organizations that I joined and activities in which I participated. While at the university, I became a member of the Young People's Socialist League, the Student Peace Union, and the Congress of Racial Equality. Through these organizations, I learned to look at politics in a new way. It wasn't just that racism, war, poverty, and other social evils must be opposed. It was that there was a cause and effect dynamic and an interconnectedness between all aspects of society. Things didn't just happen by accident. There was a relationship between wealth, power, and the perpetuation of capitalism. How did the general population get the information they needed to make political decisions? Well, the media was controlled by large corporations. How did politicians get elected? Well, big money interests played a role in that as well. Who benefited from low wages and poor working conditions? Was racism just about irrational prejudice? Or was there an economic benefit in keeping the races divided? Who made the decision to go into a particular war? And who profited from that war? Was the good life really about earning more and more money so that we can consume more and more products? During that period, I met some great people, including community activists who were involved in civil rights, labor, and peace issues. I even got involved in my first political campaign, working successfully for the re-election of Alderman Leon Dupre, an independent member of the Chicago City Council, who was opposed by Mayor Daley's Democratic organization. In that campaign, I got a glimpse of what a powerful political machine, one based on patronage, could do. At that time, I also got a part-time job with a union headquartered in Chicago, the United Packing House Workers of America. The early 1960s, when I was at the University of Chicago, were turbulent years for the civil rights movement. People my age and organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, were being arrested and getting their heads broken in Mississippi, Alabama, and throughout the South as they struggled for desegregation and voting rights. I joined the core chapter on campus and eventually became vice president. A fellow student, Bruce Rappaport, was the president. While providing a bit of financial support for the civil rights movement in the South, our chapter of CORE began to focus on racism in Chicago. The University of Chicago was and is located in a largely African-American community. It turned out that the university was a major landlord in the area, and it also turned out that the university owned segregated housing. Our CORE chapter sent white couples and black couples into the university-owned housing, pretending to be looking for an apartment to rent. A black couple would find there were just no apartments available. A few hours later, a white couple would find a choice of apartments in the same building. After unsuccessful negotiations with the university to desegregate their housing, our CORE chapter staged a sit-in demonstration in the administration building. It was one of the first student civil rights sit-ins in the North. During that same period, working with a citywide organization, I got arrested during a demonstration to desegregate the Chicago public school system, a struggle that went on for years and later involved Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The Chicago schools were bad in general. They were worse in the black neighborhoods. Instead of allowing black children in overcrowded schools to go to white ones, the school department established mobile classrooms to perpetuate the segregation. Hundreds of Chicagoans protested. During our demonstration, the police demarcated a line that couldn't be crossed. If you crossed that line, you would be arrested. Several of us crossed that line, and we were thrown into paddy wagons. I spent the night in jail. In the morning, we were bailed out by the NAACP. As part of my civil rights activities, I was also involved in a movement to protest police brutality. In that capacity, I made an unwelcome acquaintance with the Chicago Police Department when some local police followed me in their squad car and took down leaflets I had been posting announcing a public meeting on police violence. They referred to me in language that became familiar during that period as a quote-unquote outside agitator. A few years later, during the Democratic Convention of 1968, the entire world saw the Chicago police in action during the infamous police riots. Their brutality did not surprise me. In August 1963, a number of my fellow University of Chicago students and I took a long bus ride to participate in the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. For me, it was an unforgettable experience, led by one of the great leaders in the history of our country. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a man of enormous courage who followed the path that his conscience and intelligence dictated. Yes, he was an important civil rights leader who, against enormous obstacles, helped desegregate the South and pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But incredibly, he was more than that. He understood that if real justice in this country was to be established for people of every race, we had to create an economy that worked for all and not just for the few. As he often reminded the country, desegregating a restaurant meant nothing if a black worker didn't have the money to pay for the meal being served. Against very strong opposition from his financial backers and quote-unquote, liberal supporters, King spoke out against the war in Vietnam. How could he be consistent in his belief in nonviolence if he didn't oppose that war and its horrific brutality? How could he continue his demand for a change in national priorities if he didn't speak out against a bloated military budget while the poor were going hungry and the sick were without health care? King, taking on the entire establishment, plunged ahead into uncharted territory and media hostility. He demanded that the issues of poverty and income and wealth inequality be addressed. He refused to be just a great black civil rights leader. Instead, he became a great American leader who was black. Let us not forget, King was assassinated not in a quote-unquote civil rights demonstration, but in the fight for decent wages and working conditions for garbage collectors in Memphis, Tennessee. At the time of his death, he was also organizing a Poor People's March on Washington for people of all races. Standing on the National Mall on August 28, 1963, with hundreds of thousands of others, was a day that I will never forget. King's I Have a Dream speech still rings in my mind. His life's work continues to inspire me. In June 1964, I married a classmate of mine at the University of Chicago, Deborah Schilling. My father had died the previous year and left my brother and me a bit of money. Deborah and I bought 85 acres of woodland in Middlesex, Vermont for $2,500. We worked hard to convert an old maple sugar house on the property into a livable cabin. There was no electricity or running water, but we did build a very nice outhouse. We bathed in a cold stream in the middle of the woods, really cold. After our graduation from the University of Chicago, Deborah and I traveled to England, Greece, and Israel. In England, we visited Summerhill, the radical school started by A.S. Neal back in 1921. Summerhill was based on the very democratic and sane principle that the school should serve the needs of the children, not the other way around. To as great a degree as possible, children learn what they wanted and how they wanted and had a democratic voice in how the school was run. Neal's belief, way ahead of its time, was that we must keep children's intellectual and emotional spirits alive, not crush them, as so many schools did. In Greece, we spent time in Athens, where we did the tourist thing and were thrilled by the Parthenon, other ancient monuments, and Greek food. Having read some of Nikos Kazantzakis' novels, we also took a trip to Crete, where, in the rural areas, we observed the way of life that seemed unchanged from a century before. In Israel, we spent time working on several kibbutzim. It was a unique experience and a very different type of culture than I was used to. I enjoyed picking grapefruits, netting fish on the fish farm, and doing other agricultural work. Mostly, however, it was the structure of the community that impressed me. People there were living their democratic values. The kibbutz was owned by the people who lived there, the quote-unquote bosses, were elected by the workers, and the overall decisions for the community were made democratically. I recall being impressed by how young-looking and alive the older people there were. Democracy, it seemed, was good for one's health. Vermont. In 1968, I moved to Vermont more or less full-time. Deborah and I had divorced, and I was then living with Susan Mott. We had met when we were both working at a Head Start program in New York City. On March 21st, 1969, Levi Noah Sanders, our son, was born in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. One of the more interesting jobs that I had during that period was doing research at the State of Vermont Tax Department in the waning days of the administration of Governor Phil Hoff. This was my introduction to tax policy. Hoff had been the first Democratic governor elected in Vermont in 100 years. He was also one of the most progressive elected officials in the country. Years later, I had the privilege of getting to know Phil and his wife, Joan, quite well. During those years, I worked as a journalist for several Vermont papers. In the St. Albans area of northern Vermont, I wrote for a weekly newspaper and learned a lot by simply going out, stopping people, and doing man-on-the-street interviews. I found that the views of ordinary people, for better or worse, did not necessarily jibe with those of the establishment. I was surprised by the kind of support that George Wallace was generating. During that period, I also became part of the construction crew for John Rogers of Barre, Vermont. John, whose family was part Native American and went back generations in Vermont, was an excellent carpenter and builder. He taught me a lot about building homes and farm silos. He also exposed me to the Vermont way of life, something I was just beginning to absorb. Not only was John knowledgeable about construction matters, but he also knew every inch of central Vermont. Like most Vermonters, he loved the outdoors. In the warm weather, he and his family explored the area in cars, trucks, and on motorcycles. In the winter, they were out on snowmobiles. Years later, I had the opportunity of seeing the incredible winter beauty of Vermont by traveling through forests on a snowmobile. John and I grew up in very different worlds. That resulted in great discussions in his truck as we traveled to work sites. In 1969, Susan, Levy, and I lived in a small house we had bought in the town of Stannard, Vermont. Stannard, with a population of fewer than 200 people, is located in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom, one of the poorest, most rugged, and beautiful parts of the state. There are no stores, no schools, no post offices, no paved roads in Stannard. And in the winter, the main dirt road going over the mountain to Lindenville is closed because of snow and ice. I learned a lot living in Stannard. I learned about the beauty of walking on quiet dirt roads, seeing deer in the fields, and finding paths that led to the remains of old farmhouses that had not been occupied for decades. I learned about the friendships established when you live in an isolated community 5 miles from the nearest store or gas station. People need people, and that developed a different type of community than I had previously known. I learned about surviving in cold weather and trying to keep our baby warm when the temperature was 20 below zero and the cold air leaked in through poorly insulated walls. I learned very quickly why people put plastic over their windows. Not pretty, but it keeps the cold air out. I learned about getting by when the pipes freeze and you have no running water, and now you have to haul large plastic water jugs so that you can stay clean, wash the dishes, and flush the toilet. I learned about starting a car after a cold, cold night when the tires were actually frozen to the ground. One day I was visiting a neighbor who was the town's road commissioner, the guy responsible for plowing the roads after it snowed. This was no minor position. If the roads were not open, people couldn't get to work, reach a doctor, go to school. My eyes nearly popped out of my head when I saw him put a car battery into the stove in his kitchen. Was he totally crazy? Not really. The pilot light in the oven kept the battery warm overnight, which enabled him to start up the town plow in the morning, no matter what the weather had been. Chapter 2, My Political Life in Vermont. I think it's fair to say that my political life has taken a very different path from that of any other member of Congress. It's not just that I'm the longest-serving independent in its history. It's not just that my first visits to Washington, D.C. were all for civil rights and anti-war demonstrations. It's not just that I was never inside the Capitol until after I ran for Congress. It's that I started way, way outside of establishment politics. Jim Rader is my oldest friend. I have known him since my days at the University of Chicago, and we renewed our acquaintance after Chicago when we bumped into each other at a meeting in Vermont in the late 60s. In late 1971, Jim mentioned to me that he was going to a meeting of the Liberty Union Party, a small third party in Vermont. Winston Prouty, Vermont's U.S. Senator, had died in September, and a special election was being held to elect his successor. Robert Stafford, Vermont's lone congressman at the time, was giving up his position in the House to run for Prouty's seat, which meant that there would be 2 seats up for grabs. "Would you be interested in going to the meeting?" Jim asked. "The party will be discussing the issues to be covered in the campaign and will nominate its candidates." "Why not?" I answered. A fateful decision. The Liberty Union meeting was held in a room at Goddard College in central Vermont. By definition, the 40 or 50 people there were opinionated. There was a lot of discussion. Not being shy, I added my 2 cents worth. I recall talking about economics, education, the war in Vietnam, and a few other subjects. At a certain point in the meeting, nominations were in order. Who would be the Liberty Union candidate for the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. House? There were not a whole lot of takers. Doris Lake, one of the founders of the party with her husband Peter Diamondstone, was nominated for the House. And I was nominated for the Senate. Yes, the Senate. Welcome to grassroots politics. Welcome to Vermont politics. Needless to say, my campaign had no money, no organization, and very few in the party had the vaguest idea of how to run for office. But we did the best we could with what we had, and we learned as we went along. Among other issues, our campaign focused on economic justice, opposition to the war in Vietnam, and women's rights. As I think back, I realized that my campaign was not only a great learning experience and a lot of fun, but it laid the foundation for everything I have done politically since. During that campaign, I did as much research as I could into the major issues facing the country, something I very much enjoyed doing, and spoke my mind about them. I didn't worry about who I offended. I didn't worry about how I looked. A few years ago, I was named by some publication as the worst-dressed member of the U.S. Senate. Trust me, compared with how I look then, I am Mr. GQ today. Vermont is a small state, but there were radio stations and newspapers prepared to do interviews in most of the larger towns, and we took advantage of every opportunity we could to get the word out. I remember the first radio interview I did. It was on WVMT in Colchester, one of the largest stations in the state. The interviewer was Jack Barry, a well-known fixture of Vermont media, and I was nervous, very nervous. The people who listened to that show may or may not have agreed with what I said, but what they probably remember was a constant thumping sound on their radios. I was so nervous that my knee kept shaking and banging up against the table. The sound engineer kept waving his arms for me to stop, but there it was, my first radio interview. Thump, thump, thump. As the campaign proceeded, I did better and became more focused. It was difficult at the beginning, but I became more and more comfortable standing on street corners handing out literature. I discovered that I liked talking to strangers about politics. I also did reasonably well in the debates. I was running against Republican Congressman Robert Stafford, the odds-on favorite to win. Maybe hard to believe now, given the complexion of contemporary Vermont politics, but in 1971, no Democrat had ever been elected to the United States Senate. Randy Major, a state representative, was giving it a try. During that campaign, I got my first personal glimpse of the nature of the media's political coverage. Randy, a very strong underdog in that race, came up with an imaginative way to capture attention. It was winter in Vermont, and he said he would ski around the state to meet the voters, and that ploy worked. Throughout the campaign, the media was talking about the skiing candidate. Here I was, pontificating about the major issues facing humanity, and the TV cameras were focused on the blisters on Randy's feet. Needless to say, neither Randy's skiing nor my pontificating made much difference. In January 1972, Bob Stafford won the special election by 31 points. Spending less than $1,000, I came in third with only 2% of the vote. The Republican candidate for the House, Richard Mallory, also won a landslide victory. An aside here about the Vermont Republican Party of the 1970s. It was different in almost every way from the National Republican Party of today. Was Bob Stafford a fiscal conservative? Yes, he was. But he was also pro-choice and was a strong advocate for the environment and education. Remarkably, in the last years of his life, when he was living in retirement in Rutland, Vermont, this 87-year-old, lifelong Republican and former military officer came out strongly for gay rights. There was a very bitter debate in Vermont in 2000 as to whether our state should be the first in the nation to pass civil union legislation. Stafford strongly supported it, which paved the way for other Republican support and made passage easier. But Stafford was not alone as a moderate Vermont Republican. He was preceded by U.S. Senator George Aiken, a liberal Republican who served in the Senate for 34 years. Stafford was later followed to the Senate by Republican Jim Jeffords, another moderate. Many people still remember that in 2001, it was Senator Jim Jeffords who left the Republican Party because of its growing right-wing tilt, became an independent, and shifted control of the Senate to the Democrats. Not content with the 2% of the vote that I received in the special election, I ran for governor, again on the Liberty Union ticket, in the general election 6 months later in 1972. This time I received 1% of the vote. I was on the move, just in the wrong direction. During that campaign, I became involved for the first time in my life in a presidential campaign. Dr. Benjamin Spock, the world-renowned pediatrician, was running for president on the People's Party ticket and was supported by the Liberty Union Party. I campaigned with Spock when he visited Vermont. The year 1974 was the Liberty Union Party's high point. Michael Parenti, who was ousted from his teaching position at the University of Vermont because of his opposition to the war in Vietnam, ran an excellent campaign for Congress and received 7% of the vote. Martha Abbott and Art Deloy, our candidates for governor and lieutenant governor, received 5% of the vote. Nancy Kaufman, a young attorney who was Liberty Union candidate for attorney general, received 6%. In 1974, I ran again for the U.S. Senate. This was a tough race. Senator George Aiken had retired, and it was widely expected that Republican Congressman Richard Mallory would replace him. But a young liberal Democratic state's attorney named Patrick Leahy mounted a very strong campaign against him. One of the never-ending dilemmas facing third-party candidates is that you're often considered a quote-unquote spoiler. People like your views. They want to vote for you, but they fear that a candidate they really dislike might get elected if they quote-unquote waste their vote. That certainly affected the low total that I got. I ended up with 4%, less than I expected, but double what I had ever received before. In a major surprise, Leahy won the election. Leahy and I now serve together in the Senate and have been friends for years. Occasionally, we reminisce about the campaign of 1974. In 1976, I ran for governor again. During that campaign, I was invited to participate in a primetime debate on the largest television station in the state. I did well in that debate, which helped me reach my all-time high as a Liberty Union candidate of 6%. That turned out to be my last campaign with the Liberty Union Party. I was proud of what we had accomplished. I was proud that we were able to educate people in Vermont about some of the most important issues facing our state and country, and to give them a progressive perspective outside of the two-party system. I was proud of our often successful efforts in opposing utility rate increases and supporting striking workers. Further, since many of our candidates were women, we played a major role in breaking down sexism in state politics. We had done extremely well with the limited resources and people that we had, but it was time for me to move on. I was out of politics. With politics behind me, I set out to make a living and began building a reasonably successful small business. With the help of a few co-workers, I wrote, produced, and sold film strips for schools on the history of Vermont and other New England states. The market was too small for the big companies, so we more or less had the field to ourselves. The business was a lot of fun. In the process, I improved my writing skills and learned something about photography, marketing, and door-to-door salesmanship. I also met a lot of amazing educators. In 1979, after discovering that most of the college students I spoke to had never heard of Eugene Victor Debs, I produced a 30-minute video on his life and ideas. Debs was a great American, but his life and work remain largely unknown. He was a man of extraordinary courage and integrity, whose tireless efforts on behalf of workers and the poor laid the groundwork for many of the programs established by FDR during the New Deal. Debs was the founder of the American Socialist Party and a six-time candidate for president. In 1920, he received nearly 1 million votes, running from a jail cell after being imprisoned for his opposition to World War I. The life of Eugene V. Debs, his vision of a world of peace, justice, democracy, and brotherhood, has always been an inspiration to me. I have a plaque of Debs on a wall in my Washington Senate office. The Debs video was sold and rented to colleges throughout the country, and we also managed to get it shown on public television in Vermont. In addition, Folkways Records produced the soundtrack of the video on vinyl. I very much enjoyed the small media business that I was running. I didn't make a lot of money, but I was able to make my own decisions, work my own hours, and learn a lot. I was looking forward to a future of making more videos on aspects of American history that were unfamiliar to the American people. In 1980, my life as a small businessman came to an end. I was back in politics. Socialism in one city. Richard Sugarman has been one of my closest friends for 40 years. He is a professor of religion at the University of Vermont, a philosopher, and author of a number of important books and publications, an expert on baseball statistics, and a Hasidic Jew. He also follows politics very closely. In late fall 1980, Richard had a strange idea. "Run for mayor of Burlington as an independent," he said. "You can win." He had analyzed the 1976 results of my gubernatorial run. Statewide, I won 6% of the vote. In Burlington, I won 12%, and in the working-class wards of the city, I carried over 16% of the vote. Richard figured that if we focused all of our attention on Burlington, we had a shot to win. We brought a number of our political friends together, many of them former colleagues from the Liberty Union, and we talked it out. It would be a tough race. We would be taking on a five-term Democratic incumbent who had not had serious opposition in years, as well as the entire economic and political establishment of the city. As usual, we had no money or organization. We were starting from scratch. Once the decision to run had been made, the strategy became pretty clear. We would run a campaign based on coalition politics. We would try to bring together under one umbrella the many diverse elements of the city that were unhappy with the current city leadership. And there were a lot of them. Over the years, as is often the case in urban politics, the administration had drifted further and further away from the neighborhoods and the working class families of the city, and closer and closer to the downtown business community and the moneyed interests. We reached out to every possible group and organization that we could, and we had good results. We brought into the campaign some of the municipal unions that were upset about paltry wage increases and poor labor relations practices. We attracted tenants and their organizations that were getting very little help from the city as rents skyrocketed. We brought abroad low-income groups that were unhappy with how the city was running the public housing system. We got the support of neighborhood activists who opposed the construction of a highway that would run right through their community. Environmentalists joined us in opposition to a disastrous high-rise condominium project on the waterfront of Lake Champlain, the city's most precious natural resource. They also joined me in opposition to a major expansion of the hospital that would encroach into a neighborhood. On top of all that, the mayor was preparing